This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 18, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Los Angeles elects its first Mexican-American mayor in over 130 years. Luis Posadas Carriles, wanted by both Cuba and Venezuela for terrorism, is arrested by the Department of Homeland Security. And the FBI faces a lawsuit over documents tied to the surveillance of activist groups. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Another newly appointed Iraqi official was assassinated today in Iraq. The Interior Ministry's Brigadier General Ibrahim Kahamas was shot dead by four gunmen as he rode through Baghdad. According to one report, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, an organization led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, claims responsibility in an internet statement. Iraqi officials say they will increase security around government leaders. Palestinian elections in the Gaza Strip may be tossed out for noted irregularities. Manar Jabrin has more from the International Middle East Media Center.
Today, the Legislative Council met to discuss the Palestinian elections law that was approved in the first and second readings and is scheduled to be presented to the Council next week. The delay of the parliament elections proposed by the ruling party Fatah was not discussed. In a move that could increase tension between Hamas and Fatah, a Palestinian court cancelled on Tuesday the voting results in 51 of the 141 polling stations in the southern Gaza Strip city of Rafah. The court decision came after finding irregularities in voter registration lists and ballot boxes. For Free Speech Radio News from the International Middle East Media Center, IMEMC.org, in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
Today, the Republican leadership brought President Bush's controversial judicial nomination, Priscilla Owen, to the Senate floor, moving forward on the showdown over the filibuster. Mitch Jezerich has more from D.C.
For 4 years, Senate Democrats have blocked Priscilla Owen's nomination to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, claiming she is biased towards corporate and anti-abortion interests. But Republican Senator John Cornyn, who sat on the Texas Supreme Court with Owen, praised her record.
She was supported by a larger percentage of Texans in her last election than any of her colleagues, 84%, after enjoying the endorsement of virtually every newspaper in the state.
Beginning the debate on the Owens nomination indicates the Senate is just days from a potential vote on the so-called nuclear option to eliminate the use of a filibuster on judicial nominees. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois.
To sweep away 214 years of precedent and rules so that someone can score a quick victory in terms of even one, two, or 10 judges is entirely inappropriate.
Since 2001, Congress has confirmed 208 out of 218 presidential judicial nominations. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
Mobilizations by public school teachers in Mexico are intensifying after 2 weeks of strikes in Chiapas. Latin America correspondent Shannon Young reports.
Since Monday, at least 200 public school teachers in Chiapas have been fired or have had their contracts canceled for failure to appear at work after beginning a strike over 2 weeks ago. Additionally, a handful of dissident teachers are now in prison. Organized public school teachers have been struggling for 25 years for what they call the democratization of their union. Over the decades, the conflict has taken various turns and claimed numerous lives. The dissident teachers have announced the possibility of a nationwide strike beginning this Friday. Faced with this threat, Mexico's Secretary of Government is reportedly meeting with teachers today and tomorrow for negotiations. For FSRN, this is Shannon Young in Oaxaca.
United Nations representatives arrived in Indonesia to evaluate the human rights tribunals of those accused of committing crimes in East Timor. Maggie Margiona reports from Jakarta.
The UN Commission of Experts, or COE members, from India, Japan, and Fiji start their three-day mission on Wednesday to evaluate the judicial process against members of the Indonesian military and officials charged with involvement in the 1999 violence in East Timor. A high court has freed Indonesian military officers who committed serious crimes. Also, the Supreme Court freed the formerly jailed East Timor governor. In addition, the commander of pro-Indonesian militias, who is now jailed, has submitted a review to the Supreme Court and may possibly be freed as well. Agung Yuda of the Institute for Community Studies and Advocacy, an NGO that will monitor the tribunal, says that this is exactly why the UN committee is reviewing the judicial process.
Nah, ini yang kemudian membuat That is why the international law community and UN members are dissatisfied by the legal process in Jakarta, and the option for an international tribunal that was declined is now re-endorsed.
Reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
A peaceful 17-day protest march by 12,000 landless farmers in Brazil ended yesterday in the worst violence seen in years. 50 people were injured when mounted police charged them as they tried to bring their grievance to President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The farmers, represented by the organization MST, accused the government of being slow to institute land reforms and have been settling land around the country. The president promised to settle hundreds of thousands of people by the year 2006. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
After a landslide election, the city of Los Angeles has a new mayor. Antonio Villaraigosa beat incumbent James Hahn by a nearly 20-point margin. Sol Rebel Radio's Laura Cambron reports from KPFK.
Antonio Villaraigosa is the first Mexican-American or Chicano mayor for the city in well over a century. His background in the community includes being president of the Association of Government Employees, where he worked in the Los Angeles office of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that was founded to enforce the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He was also a board member of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and also participated in the Black-Brown Roundtable in the mid-80s. Villaraigosa's labor and community background helped serve as a launchpad for his campaign platform, where he claimed he alone could unite LA's various ethnic groups and make the city work. Because Los Angeles is the largest city on the West Coast, many people were interested in the results of this election. As the second largest city in the nation after New York, and the city with the highest concentration of people of Mexican descent outside of Mexico, in a state where whites will no longer be the majority, the Latino community in particular is intrigued by the possibilities that this may bring greater political representation for them. Diana Zamora traveled over 100 miles from San Diego to be in Los Angeles for this historic election.
It's called Los Angeles. It's about time we had a Latino mayor. Today, I really felt that there was tons and tons of high school volunteers here, which I thought was phenomenal. I got a chance to work with some, and they are great, and they're really excited about this. And they are doing this because they feel that he's the right person, and they feel they can connect with him on a certain level.
Although the anxiety associated with Election Day was hardly to be found on LA's streets, some residents got behind what they saw as a viable candidate. Charlie Connor is a 17-year-old white male from the middle-class LA suburb of Northridge. He volunteered on Villaraigosa's campaign because he felt that the participation of young people is vital to the political landscape of the city.
Young people, you know, sometimes against their own good, are too honest. And politicians are not generally known as the most honest people, mostly because they get older and they get bitter. So you know what happens.
4 years ago, Hahn promised to fund an after-school program in every elementary school in the city, increase funding for street resurfacing, with particular focus on South Los Angeles, get tough on crime, and help its impoverished residents. Tyrone Lewis, a lifetime LA resident, was one of the people caught up in the former mayor's plan to relocate homeless residents.
And it's sad, you know what I'm saying? Hahn brag about he cleaned up this and he cleaned up there. But poor people, homeless people, you know what I'm saying? That's what he's been cleaning up. It's homeless people, you know what I'm saying? He ain't putting everybody downtown and doing nothing for nobody. And it's just not be impressive. It's nothing, it's a waste. Swept them from one part of the town to another part of the town. That's all he did. Villaraigosa, I hope he do a lot better, you know what I'm saying? And I'm glad for him. You know what I'm saying? And that's, I got swept, got caught in that sweep. So I know it well. And no, Hahn, I mean, it's nothing like his father. You know what I'm saying? I miss his father.
Hahn's name resonated in the African-American community 4 years ago thanks to the work of his father, Kenneth Hahn, who served on the County Board of Supervisors a record 10 terms. Kenneth Hahn built a reputation in the South LA community for having a commitment to civil rights issues and for bringing a much-needed hospital to the district. This time, however, James Hahn faced an uphill battle with many African-American voters. In a controversial move early in his tenure, Han did not back the reappointment of African-American Police Chief Bernard Parks. Parks ran for mayor himself in the first round. When he was defeated, he threw his support behind Villaraigosa in the runoffs. Still, others were disappointed with Han due to what they saw as a campaign marked by racially charged accusations leveled by the incumbent mayor against Villaraigosa. Although this is a historic vote, voter turnout was dramatically low, at only about 30%. Abraham is a student at Los Angeles City College. He, like many other young people in the city, say that they are apathetic because they feel disenfranchised from the political process.
So I guess I'm not going to vote for any one of them now. We got the president, we got the senator, we got the governor, they're all the same, so I think we're not going to change anything soon.
Villaraigosa's term begins July 1st. Angelinos are hopeful he will live up to his promises, such as speeding the development of new renewable energy sources and recycling most of the city's trash, and taking control and oversight over the Los Angeles Unified School District. Villaraigosa says he will try to build an inclusive government that seeks to balance the interests of varied constituencies, as he did during his tenure in the State Assembly. With Seoul Rebel Radio, I'm Laura Cambron for Free Speech Radio News.
The ACLU, along with four animal rights and environmental groups, announced a lawsuit against the FBI today over documents tied to the surveillance of political activities, such as anti-war organizing. The lawsuit has been filed because the FBI has denied Freedom of Information Act requests for the documents. From Washington, Jenny Johnson reports.
Freedom of Information Act requests for thousands of documents have been met with only about 20 pages from the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force in 5 months' time. While this lack of a response to the FOIA request has prompted a lawsuit to compel more documents, the small amount of information the American Civil Liberties Union has obtained reveals potential abuse of surveillance authority. Ben Weisner, an attorney with the New York ACLU.
One document in particular describes ongoing FBI interest in the group Food Not Bombs, which serves vegetarian meals to the homeless and protests war and poverty around the world. And the FBI in Colorado, prior to last summer's political conventions, went around and did a series of what they described as pretext interviews to talk to, and we believe intimidate, young activists who were planning to go and protest those conventions.
Several groups, along with the ACLU, are filing a lawsuit against the FBI and Department of Justice to compel fulfillment of previous FOIA requests. At the same time, more FOIA requests in additional states are being made. The strategy is to find out about orders to monitor, interrogate, investigate, or infiltrate these organizations and the maintenance of records on them. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals is a plaintiff. It has documented harassment and intimidation of employees and volunteers. Attorney Jeff Kerr is PETA's general counsel.
We had one incident in which one of our people was pulled over on the side of a public highway in California and was simply taking a photograph from a public road of a huge feedlot where thousands of cows who were being bred for slaughter were standing in this huge, muddy, open field. Purely for taking a photograph of that, he and the people traveling with him were detained on the side of the highway for 3 hours, fingerprinted, and interrogated, and under circumstances in which they were not free to go.
The American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee is another plaintiff. The group has documented abuse of Arab Americans under law enforcement authorities who use race, national origin, and religion as a basis for questioning. Lila Al-Khatami describes how the group knows of the abuse.
One would be FOIA documents that have already been released. And the other way that we've received information and been aware of this is direct contact with people who feel that they've been targeted. And this is, you know, aggressive questioning of our Arabs and Muslims solely, it seems, on the basis of religion and national origin, as opposed to actually any suspicion of wrongdoing.
The memos that have so far been released come from the Joint Terrorism Task Force. This is a partnership between local law enforcement and the FBI that grants federal authority to local anti-terrorism efforts. Mr. Weisner believes groups that oppose government policy are being targeted.
There's a real danger, particularly in 2005, when individuals and groups like these find themselves in FBI files under the heading Joint Terrorism Task Force. With the proliferation of federal databases, we have no idea what the consequences might be of information like that being gathered in that way. And we've heard enough stories of people going to airports and having difficulty getting on planes, having difficulty opening up bank accounts, that we think citizens have a right to know, and the government has an obligation to tell us, what kind of information is being collected about these groups and why.
Lila Al-Khatami of the ADC also describes the need for more information.
We don't know how wide the net is, and we don't know how far it has been cast. You know, it's a matter of, we'd like to get the information. This is why we filed the lawsuit. We don't really know how far the net is, though.
Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
Close to 300 people gathered to protest Halliburton today in downtown Houston, where the company's annual shareholder meeting took place. Amid 16 arrests and some injuries, protesters say they're blowing the whistle on a company that's defrauding people in Iraq and the United States. From KPFT in Houston, Mayra Moreno has more.
Protesters held a signature banner that read Halliburton out of Iraq. People, power, healthcare, and education, not corporate occupation. Other signs read, stop cronyism. Houstonian Keith Kofsky wore a Dick Cheney mask to draw connections between Halliburton, its subsidiary KBR, and the Bush administration's push to invade and occupy Iraq.
And I dress like Dick Cheney, vice president of the United States military-industrial complex, in order to stand in front of this giant cow that we have here on the corner to demonstrate that Halliburton and Dick Cheney and the U.S. government are milking the people of Iraq and of the United States for over $1.8 billion.
Inside the hotel at Halliburton's shareholder meeting, activists carried out a nonviolent civil disobedience action. Kendall Greenlee fought in the first Gulf War as a Marine. Today, he sat outside the hotel in handcuffs.
We staged a protest inside the lobby, outside of the ballroom where the shareholders were holding. We took over possession of the entryway into the corridor where the guests have to file through to enter into the shareholders' meeting. We held that up for about 10 minutes until the officers came. They asked us three times to leave. The hotel staff asked us to leave three times. We told them that we refused to until our demands were met.
Seven people were arrested inside. Nine more were arrested outside. Two arrested were indie media videographers. Coverage of the actual shareholder meeting was difficult not only for independent media, but also corporate media. Only five invited news reporters were allowed at the meeting. Global Exchange's Medea Benjamin attended the meeting as a shareholder.
One thing that people don't know, which we understand better having been inside, is Halliburton is really freaked about the bad publicity around the work in Iraq, and that's why they plan to sell off Kellogg Brown and Root. And they won't give a timeline on when they're doing, but it was very clear to us inside that they don't feel like they're making enough money from the government contracts because it's cost plus, which only gives them 1% and possibly 2% if they get a bonus.
Back outside the hotel, a breakaway march circled a parking garage. Police on horseback corralled protesters near a garage entrance, bringing the horses onto the sidewalk and using their long wooden batons.
Boom, like we started rushing through and a horse stepped on her foot.
Several protesters reported being injured when they were trampled by horses. Protester Michelle Brackman was caught in the fray.
The whole time the police had been on the mounted on horses with their guns, and billy clubs and everything else, prepared for combat, the horses with the knee pads and all of that. And they were lining the streets, so I don't know what they thought we were going to do, but they were antagonistic. They were.
Houston police defended their behavior.
They may characterize it as an overreaction. We would characterize it as a police action to prevent them from blocking access to the Four Seasons Hotel, either their garage or their pedestrian entrance.
As of airtime, those arrested today had yet to be released. Activists with the local anti-war group Houston Global Awareness Collective vowed to keep up the pressure on Halliburton to cease operation in Iraq.
All right. There it goes. Vietnam is back. Now they call it Iraq. Vietnam is back. Now they call it Iraq. Vietnam is back.
From Houston, Texas, I'm Mayra Moreno for Free Speech Radio News.
Now they call it Iraq.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. Archives of our program are available on the web at fsrn.org. After a two-month delay, the Department of Homeland Security arrested Luis Posada Carriles yesterday, who is wanted on terrorism charges in Venezuela and Cuba. The arrest came hours after a massive demonstration in Havana against his presence on U.S. soil. Posada and his cohort Orlando Bosch are identified by Havana, Caracas, and the FBI as being responsible for the bombing of a Cuban airliner in 1976 in which everyone on board lost their lives. Joseph Muti reports from Havana.
Esta no es una marcha contra el pueblo de Estados Unidos. Es una marcha contra el terrorismo.
This is not a march against the people of the United States, said Cuban President Fidel Castro early yesterday. It is a march against terrorism, for life and for peace. Down with terrorism. Then, to the sound of the Cuban national anthem, the Cuban leader led 1.2 million people on a protest march past the U.S. Interest Section here in Havana, the largest such demonstration in Cuban history. Cubans are angry that the international Cuban-born terrorist, Luis Posada Carriles, was allowed to remain illegally on U.S. territory in clear opposition to the famous post-9/11 declaration of the U.S. president that anyone who harbors a terrorist is also a terrorist. They see the White House refusal to admit Posada's presence in the U.S. as carrying more favor with the right-wing Cuban-American community in Miami, who many say put Bush in the Oval Office. Nobody on the march was unfamiliar with the names of the two men.
Posada Carriles is legally in the state, and that's bad because he killed a lot of people. We want justice, the real justice for Posada Carriles and others like Orlando Bosch.
In 1990, Cuban-born Bosch was granted a pardon and residency in the U.S. by George Bush Sr. against the advice of his own Justice Department, and in spite of the fact that 32 countries refused to give him asylum. It is still one of the most condemned acts by any U.S. president against Cuba to date. Although Venezuela has an extradition demand for Posada filed with the U.S., and although Havana has renounced any right to try him in Cuba in deference to Caracas, U.S. authorities were quick to say that they would not hand the terrorist over to any country that was especially friendly with Cuba, i.e., Venezuela. Cubans, least of all Fidel Castro, are not going to let this one go. The hope that the case would fade failed, with Cuba managing to get the whole affair front-page coverage by the U.S. press. When the 48 hours are up, all eyes will be on the U.S. White House. In Havana, for Free Speech Radio, I'm Joseph Muti.
Justicia! 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 Justicia!
Poverty, education, and women are the topics at the fourth annual forum led by Indigenous people at the United Nations. The forum has brought together hundreds of Indigenous people from around the world to open dialogue on issues often ignored by governments. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more from the United Nations.
This year's forum will focus on the implementation of the United Nations Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs, which are to substantially reduce poverty, disease, and discrimination by the year 2015. Indigenous peoples say the MDGs are plummeting their communities further into poverty and diminishing their access to education and health care. The focus on this conference was based on a report last year compiled by the UN Interagency Support Group of Indigenous Issues. It found that Indigenous peoples were neither consulted nor were their needs addressed when implementing the MDGs. The definition of poverty is of concern to Indigenous groups who don't need money, just access to their land. Tarsila Reversia, a Quechua from Peru, a descendant from the Inca civilization and coordinator in Enluche Continental, an international network of indigenous women.
If you look at the definition of Western society, poverty is determined by how much money you have. Indigenous people determine their status of poverty or wealth in relation to other things, in relation to territory, in relation to a healthy environment, in relation to agriculture and agricultural products, in relation to good health. Clearly, you will see us as extremely poor if you determine our status according to money, which is the Western determination.
Indigenous communities here recommend that the profits received from extracting resources from their land should be put back into their community in a just and equitable manner, rather than monetary handouts from the governments, which is often a form of subsidy. Again, Tarsila, speaking on a panel through a UN interpreter.
We see that it's very dangerous that the states are implementing policies that are just sort of charity. In Peru, the state is offering $30 a month. In Peru, there are indigenous sisters who disagree with that policy because it doesn't solve the structural problems and it creates a dependency of indigenous peoples on the state.
Viviana Figuera is with Juve Indigena, an indigenous youth group from Argentina. She speaks on the same panel with the same interpreter about the disparity in policies towards indigenous groups.
To achieve the first Millennium Development Goal, there needs to be a rights-based approach. There needs to be a human rights criteria for the evaluation of any sort of eradication of poverty. Because if our rights are violated, it really threatens the very future of our people.
A document to determine the human rights of indigenous peoples has been in the drafting process for 10 years. Member states who must sign the declaration cannot agree on the provisions. In its most supportive stance to date, the United Nations pledged to move beyond the goals of this forum and urge member states to adopt the Indigenous Human Rights Declaration. Deputy Secretary General Luis Frechette.
The United Nations will continue to be your partner in your quest for dignity, and I trust you will be ours in bringing about a change of direction in our world.
But Tarsila questions the effectiveness of the speeches given by UN supporters.
Pero sabemos que las cosas no son fáciles.
But we also know that the reality is that those speeches are not fortified with public policy that's implemented in each of our countries. And that's why we have to continue to be vigilant and continue to monitor what they say against what they do.
Representatives here from Native American indigenous communities are fully aligned with the goals of other indigenous groups. A U.S. mission official said the United States is an active observer and will wait until a report is given to the member states to review to form an opinion on the forum. For Free Speech Radio News at the United Nations, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.